From Johnstown to Countersport, York to Pittsburgh, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Pennsylvania state budget is late, again. For the third time in 3 years under Governor Josh Shapiro, the state has missed its July 1st budget deadline. Carl Marrera, Rebecca Euler, and Stephen Bloom are here for a Capital Watch update. And the U.S. Steel Nippon Steel deal brings to a close the Rust Belt era in Pennsylvania. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. There will be at least one open congressional seat in Pennsylvania to be filled in next year's elections. U.S. Representative Dwight Evans has announced he will not seek re-election. Evans has experienced health problems which have limited his activity in recent months. The district lies within the city of Philadelphia, so it is not viewed as a potential flip by Republicans. State Senator and Pennsylvania Democratic Party Chair Sharif Street has become the first candidate to announce his intentions to seek the seat in next year's primary election. The University of Pennsylvania has entered into an agreement with the U.S. Department of Education to, as reported by the Delaware Valley Journal, quote, restore to all female athletes all individual athletic records, titles, honors, awards, or similar recognition for division swimming competitors misappropriated by male athletes competing in female categories. Further, the university will issue a letter of apology to the female students who were discriminated against. The issue arose when female students lost competitions to a biologically male swimmer. The Trump administration has held that is a violation of Title IX, which protects female sporting programs. Trash may soon be piling up in Philadelphia. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees District 33 in the city has gone on strike. The union is seeking 8% annual raises over the next 3 years, along with cost of living hikes and bonuses for those who worked through the pandemic. The city has offered raises that total 13% over the next 4 years. Efforts by House Democrats to gut cyber charter school funding have drawn a sharp rebuke from the Reverend Joshua Robertson, who runs a school in the city of Harrisburg that provides educational opportunities to underserved, mostly minority students. Robertson called on the carpet local representatives who pledged support for his school, but who have now voted to take away funding that, in his words, serve inner-city children in crisis. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Once again, Governor Josh Shapiro and lawmakers have been unable to agree on a new state budget by the June 30th constitutional deadline. Further, they appear to be in no hurry to get the job done. Carl Marrera from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. Carl?
Welcome to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome for you. I'm Carl Marrera, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, and joining me is Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, good to be with you.
Great to be with you.
And Steve Bloom, Vice President at the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Carl. It's great to be here.
Well, the budget deadline has come and gone, and still no budget. There's a laundry list of excuses, though, with state lawmakers looking to D.C. for what kind of revenue will be coming to the states. And there's the internal debates revolving around things like transit funding, skill games, and rightfully the overall spend number. But Steve, you have actually been a part of that process in your life. As your time as a state lawmaker, you've seen budget impasses yourself. And give the listeners a little bit of insight as to what's happening right now. Who are the deal makers and how is that process working?
Certainly, Carl. The budget process tends to be one in which the elected legislative leaders and the chief executive of the state, the governor, are the ones really at the table making the big decisions, pushing the ideas and trying to negotiate with each other. When I was in the House of Representatives, there was a democratically there was a Republican controlled Senate as well as a Republican governor. That made it relatively easy, though not easy, for those leaders to forge a budget agreement in some fashion in time for the deadline. With the situation here, where there's a Democratic chief executive in the state, Democratic House and Republican controlled Senate, there's much more of a standoff going on. In many cases, the top leaders of each of those entities are not necessarily getting along well with the folks they're supposed to negotiate with because of ideological differences. So you'll have a lot of positioning, a lot of posturing, attempts at negotiation, and it's a long process. And once some sort of a tentative arrangement is reached, each of those leaders has to go back, especially the legislative leaders, has to go back to their own caucus and try to make sure that they've got enough buy-in to get the votes to get it done. It's a very uncertain process. It's one in which most of the rank and file members are kept in the dark, and it is those top leaders that they elected to lead their caucuses that end up doing the hard work, the dirty work, whatever you want to call it, the difficult, the heavy lifting to try to set up a budget that makes sense for approval of all those parties that we just talked about.
So, Steve, give the listeners a little bit more of an insight as to what's on the trading table. And you know, are the things that are passed throughout the legislative session up until this point the things that become like on the trading block?
Not necessarily. It used to be a really strict rule that to be considered as part of the budget negotiation, a particular piece of legislation has to pass at least one of the chambers. But in the last 5 to 10 years, that's kind of gone by the wayside, and the legislative leaders, if it's necessary to add a big element to a budget to make it work, they will. And they'll make that effort. But you're looking at balancing the need for some spending. In this case, the governor's proposed a spending number that I certainly feels too high, that most of the folks on the fiscally conservative side of the aisle would say is just too much spending. On the other hand, the Senate, for example, has ideas around regulatory relief, around making sure that we spend something that does not impact the future security of our rainy day funds in the state, fiscally responsible, careful actions that can make sure that we have a solid direction that the Commonwealth is heading.
And Rebecca, as somebody who's been around this process for a number of years, I mean, does this impasse seem different than other years? Why or why not?
Yeah, I think, Steve touched on a couple of the reasons I think it's a little bit different. And I think one of them is he mentioned the political standoff. Obviously, we have different priorities with a Democrat governor, a Democrat House, and a Republican Senate. We have different priorities that bubble to the top of each of those parties, which have to be negotiated. And that is something that just does cause a lot of negotiation and obviously does take some time. But other than that, I think the federal uncertainty, a lot of talk over the big, beautiful bill and what that's going to mean for the states and how federal spending is going to impact the states. That also is sort of playing a part in this. But I'd say probably one of the biggest factors I think that's involved in this is the fact that we're getting a much more urgency in the crisis that we're seeing with our structural deficit. And Steve touched on this when he said about the difference in between the parties, with Shapiro proposing a $55.5 billion spending plan, which is a 9% increase in the budget this year, and the fiscally conservative side of the aisle not agreeing to that at all. So I think the scope of the differences between the two sides of that debate is huge. And like I said, the urgency of the crisis is real, because the Independent Fiscal Office, I know, estimated earlier this year that we have a structural deficit going into next year of about $6 billion. And it's looking now like it's going to be about $5 billion. But still, that's the state spending that much more money than it takes in. And that number gets bigger and bigger every year, because I think last year it was around $3 or $4 billion. So it gets bigger and bigger. And there are a lot of folks who believe that this is a critical moment for the state, and we have to solve the structural deficit problem now.
Well, I mean, on your point on the structural deficit, so Pennsylvania's 2024-25 budget was $47.6 billion. And, you know, the first rule of getting out of a hole is that you have to first stop digging. And I mean, I feel like Governor Wolf's budget, or I'm sorry, Governor Shapiro's budget proposal ignores that wisdom entirely. I mean, the hole is getting deeper and deeper. Anticipated revenues for this fiscal year are expected to fall short by about $3.6 billion. Exactly what you were saying, Rebecca. There actually, though, was a report that came out just today that showed some better than anticipated returns, but still an approximate almost $2 billion shortfall from the spend number from last year. So then you also look at another report from the Independent Fiscal Office that shows that future revenues are projected to grow by only 2.1% year over year. So that means, this is kind of some napkin math, but that the total expected revenue for 25-26 will be around $46 billion. Yet Governor Shapiro proposed a spending plan of $51.5 billion. I mean, that leaves the Commonwealth staring down a potential structural deficit of more than $5 billion. How can anyone look at this as sustainable, Steve?
Yeah, it's not sustainable, first of all. We have to recognize that. And anybody who's going to take an honest look at it is going to recognize it's not sustainable. Something has to change. But instead of changing things to reduce the level of overspending in the Pennsylvania state government system, the House Democrats and Governor Shapiro are pushing things such as a mandatory program that would cut 1% of every worker's paycheck by forcing them to participate in programs through a mandated leave type policy, a bailout of Philadelphia's mass transit system that takes funds away from rural drivers, mandated wage hikes that would drop about 1,600 jobs, a 30% increase to family electric bills thanks to carbon taxes. So the total cost of all that is about $2,600 per family of four every year. And that's what the Democrats in these negotiations are pushing. And really the lone dissenter, the voice that's saying, no, we've got to be fiscally responsible, is the Pennsylvania Senate. And they're the ones standing up to this and saying, look, we can't go there. We've got to take steps to make the deficit situation better, not worse. And what the Democrats and what the governor are asking for would clearly make things worse. And I think, again, anyone who's honestly taking a look at these numbers, they're going to see that.
So, I mean, Pennsylvania currently, and we hear this all the time from the Democratic side, that we have $11 billion in reserves. But at this rate, I mean, those funds will be exhausted within the next 3 years. And I mean, that's putting it mildly. I mean, that's in best case scenario. So, I mean, running annual deficits approaching $5 billion every year is a disaster financially. And once those reserves are gone, the state will really only have two viable options to meet the constitutional obligation that the states have, not like the federal government, to have an actual balanced budget. And those two options are to impose massive spending cuts or enact steep tax increases. I mean, there maybe is a third option of economic growth, but history has shown us that, I mean, is that really feasible? And has the legislature done anything to spur that kind of economic growth? Rebecca, what are your thoughts?
Well, there has been a move in recent years to make the state a little bit more business friendly. We have had some reforms because I think we've gotten to the point where I think everybody recognizes that Pennsylvania is not a very business friendly state. Our corporate net income tax was way too high at 9.99% just recently, and there was an agreement back in 2022 to reduce it over time. So it is decreasing every year, and it is to be finally 4.99% after 9 years of decreasing. This year, it's 8.49%. It's still one of the highest in the country, though, so we haven't made much progress along those lines yet. But there is general agreement from just about everybody that it is too high, and it's keeping businesses away from the state. And the other thing that I'll mention is last year, the governor signed a bill that increased the state's net operating loss deduction, doubling it so that it meets the federal net operating loss by 2029. So those two, and we were only one of two states that capped the net operating loss deduction below the federal limits. Those improvements will help help businesses in the Commonwealth, especially the NOL deduction is going to help startup businesses and a lot of businesses that need to put investments into their business either right away or because they have major profit loss swing cycles, which will help them manage that. So those are two improvements that we've seen. And also, I think everyone agrees that we need some regulatory reform. We've seen some progress along those lines this year. The Department of Environmental Protection implemented its SPEED program, which does allow third-party consultants to assist in processing of permits. We're glad to see that. There's a lot more that really needs to be done, though. It's not far enough yet to bring Pennsylvania into line with some of the more business-friendly states. So we're hoping there'll be a lot more progress there. And like Steve said, there have been a lot of non-business-friendly proposals that have popped up that we really need to keep down. And to the list that he already had, I would add we are the number one judicial hole in the country too, which those legal costs that really add to the cost of doing business here in the Commonwealth. So that's another thing we really need to address.
And you're listening to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome for you. I'm Carl Moreira, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, and joining me is Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, and Steve Bloom, Vice President at the Commonwealth Foundation. And we're breaking down the budget impasse that lawmakers are facing here in Harrisburg, and let's return to that conversation. I mean, to a lot of the points that you made, Rebecca, there's a critical distinction, I think, between tax rates and tax revenue. So in 2013, North Carolina had a corporate income tax rate of 6.9%. The state at North Carolina started to reduce that rate, bringing it down to today at 2.5%. That happened in 2019, but it didn't stop there. North Carolina also lowered its personal income tax rate from 4.99 in 2022 to 3.99 today. Lawmakers there are now on track to entirely phase out the corporate net income tax by 2030. And what's the result? Well, rather than facing deficits, North Carolina is currently enjoying a $1 billion surplus while holding $4 billion in reserves, and they're growing their population. They've added 600,000 new residents since 2020. Steve, do legislators look at what's happening in high-performing states? I mean, Governor Shapiro continues to reference that he's sick and tired of losing to Ohio. Well, Ohio just lowered their personal income tax to 2.75%. compared to our 3.07.
It seems like many times our lawmakers in Pennsylvania take a kind of a myopic view, a nearsighted view, and they don't really look across the borders. They may say a few catchy little comments like, we friggin' Ohio type of thing. But for the most part, we're not emulating the policies of Ohio. Ohio enacted, as you're describing here, a series of very friendly to business and enterprise new statutes, and it helped them. They did exactly what fiscal conservatives have been saying for years and observing over and over again, that if you make the market environment more competitive and lower the tax rate, you'll actually generate more revenue and attract the employers that are going to grow and invest in your state. So we see this right now across the board, particularly around the new rising issue of school choice and parental choice in their schooling that the children they are raising deserves to get to have, and making sure everyone has fair opportunities. Many, many states around the country are now enacting really robust school choice programs. Pennsylvania has some. We were early adapters back in the early 2000s, and we're getting now other states are coming around and doing a more thorough, more efficient, universal job of making sure there's school choice in their states. And Pennsylvania's standing by. There's a fight going on around that. But if we don't take action, our citizens will vote with their feet, which we've seen over and over again. We keep losing Pennsylvania residents to other states because they have policies that people like.
Well, Governor Shapiro appears to be pursuing a strategy of just spending our way into prosperity. Yet, I mean, all the data that you're referencing, I mean, it just suggests the opposite approach is what works in those high-performing states. Worse yet, just last week, the Pennsylvania House approved a tax bill implementing mandatory unitary combined reporting. Complicated name, right? But this disastrous policy would have significant negative economic consequences for Pennsylvania. Rebecca, could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, add this to the list of business non-friendly proposals that have been discussed. Basically, what mandatory unitary combined reporting does is require companies that are part of a group of affiliated companies to report the group's total income as a unitary group and then apply certain apportionment factors to determine what the taxable income is in the states that it does business in. And this would be disastrous for Pennsylvania just because of the uncertainty involved, the increased costs and complexity of filing the tax returns. It would increase the number of tax appeals, litigation involved, because there would be challenges, obviously, to the taxes levied. A lot of, debating what should be taxed and what shouldn't, and just creating an overall disincentive to do business in Pennsylvania because of all of that uncertainty, because we know that businesses need certainty to invest. I feel like it would create and what we like to call sometimes a gotcha. So businesses want to avoid uncertainty. They want to avoid gotchas. And this is just going to drive investment out of the state.
There doesn't seem to be any kind of coalescing around one issue that we can identify as the problem child and just, set out to solve it. So I'm not quite sure where this is all headed, but Steve, I welcome your final thoughts.
Well, it's going to be like any of these budget impasses. It's going to be resolved eventually under the pressure of time and the negotiation process. It's nothing that folks need to be alarmed about in terms of, are we ever going to have a budget? Yes, we'll have a budget. It's more worrisome what they actually agree to. Mm-hmm. And so far, the Senate has been standing tall and protecting the citizens of Pennsylvania against that whole host, that litany of new spending programs that you just went over, expansions in existing programs, spending in new programs. As long as the Republicans can fight that part out and make sure that that's not left on the cutting room floor when this thing is all over, we'll eventually be in good shape.
And Rebecca, we're running out of time, but your final thoughts here.
Well, I totally agree with Steve. We'll have a budget deal in the end. There's no doubt about that. I just hope that something comes out of this agreement that we'll eventually have here that points us in the direction of solving our overall fiscal issues that we have and this structural deficit in the future. So I hope we see some business-friendly incentives that make it into the budget deal that we can start to grow our economy here in Pennsylvania and make some headway.
Well, that's all for this week. To listen to this episode and any past episodes, you can go to LincolnRadioJournal.com. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, Carl. When the domestic steel industry all but died in the 1970s, Pennsylvania, along with other steelmaking states, took on the title Rust Belt. It aptly described the economic devastation brought about by the collapse of steel and its impact on communities throughout Pennsylvania, Ohio, and the Midwest. It took a while, about 50 years, but for Penns Woods, the end of the Rust Belt era came on May 30th, 2025, when President Donald Trump took to the stage at a rally in West Mifflin, Pennsylvania, to announce an historic deal between the iconic U.S. Steel and Japan's Nippon Steel. The deal preserved the presence of U.S. Steel's headquarters in Pittsburgh, the Steel City, and included billions of investment dollars to upgrade U.S. Steel's plants in the Mon Valley, destined to not only preserve steel and steel-related jobs, but to create thousands of new jobs. It was the most significant development for steel since the discovery of fire. It isn't just the U.S. Steel Nippon Steel deal that has helped Pennsylvania shed its Rust Belt image. A series of significant events have taken place which are reviving our state's economy. Most notably is the discovery and development of gas in the Marcellus Shale play. Pennsylvania sits atop more energy than Saudi Arabia. The natural gas industry has revived formerly moribund communities across the state's northern tier. Energy would play an even bigger role if state government would get out of its way. Former Governor Tom Wolf embroiled Pennsylvania in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI. REGGI is essentially a carbon tax, and the state's participation in the agreement is currently before the courts. REGGI is the sword of Damocles hanging over the head of the industry and has stalled development. If the courts consign REGGI to the dustbin of history, the gas industry is poised for expansion. And then there are promising signs that Pennsylvania is not dependent only on steel and natural gas. The community of Homer City in Indiana County was devastated by the Reggie-induced closing of the Homer City Generation Station, once the state's largest coal-fired power plant. But the site will have rebirth with the construction of a natural gas-fired generating facility. A 3,200-acre campus will generate enough electricity to power Manhattan, double the output of the former coal plant. That output will power a co-located data center campus, thousands of construction jobs, and an estimated 1,000 permanent jobs will be created as a result of the project. In South Central Pennsylvania, the shuttered Three Mile Island nuclear plant will be brought back to life by Constellation Energy, which has entered into a 20-year agreement with Microsoft and will help supply the power needed to operate its data centers in the PJM power grid. An estimated 3,400 direct and indirect jobs will be created due to the project. These additional capacity inputs to the power grid are especially timely, as Pennsylvania is attracting data centers, which are enormous consumers of electricity. Amazon has announced a $20 billion investment to expand its data center infrastructure for artificial intelligence, or AI. Its new facilities in northeastern Pennsylvania will offer training and education programs in support of the projected creation of 27,000 jobs. Taken together, these and other recent developments show Pennsylvania is not only securing the future of legacy industries such as steel, but is becoming home to emerging sectors of the U.S. economy. There are, however, looming concerns. The aforesaid mentioned Reggie has stalled development of our natural gas resources, along with the pipeline and other infrastructure construction that would position Pennsylvania as a major worldwide energy producer. State government policies continue to hamper economic development. The 2025 edition of Rich States, Poor States, produced by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ranks Pennsylvania's business climate at 36th among the 50 states. Among the factors driving the poor ranking is Pennsylvania's top marginal corporate income tax rate. We are 48th in the nation, with only two states having a worse ranking. Governor Josh Shapiro campaigned on a promise to accelerate the rate of lowering that tax. It is a promise he has yet to keep. Tax rates, along with the complexity, cost, and time it takes to navigate the state's regulatory bureaucracy, cause many businesses to bypass Pennsylvania. Lowering taxes and reducing regulation would greatly accelerate economic development in the state. It is a testament to the power of the free market that, despite all of these speed bumps, the Pennsylvania economy has shaken off the rust of the last 50 years. Now, if we can just get out of our own way, we can once again become the keystone state in the nation's economy. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WBXQ-FM and WRTA-AM in Altoona, along with WRSC-FM in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.